Thank you. Thank you, David, for that kind introduction. And before I go into the details of my speech, I did want to say a huge thank you, having heard both from Sir Patrick and Professor Mahmood, to all the civil and public servants, both in the UK government, but I'm sure in the Egyptian government, who've been beavering away on the COP26 agenda and now the COP27 agenda. And it's really important and vital work. So a big thank you to any of you who are in the room or indeed online. It's always a pleasure to speak here at the Royal Society. As we walk around this building, it's impossible not to be reminded that we're standing on the shoulders of giants. But we also know that the severe weather brought to us by a changing climate threatens to throw us off. So as well as racing to net zero, we must become more resilient and learn to adapt to the future that scientists and climate activists have long warned us about, and which has quite frankly been a reality for some of the most climate vulnerable countries for decades. This future is now a reality for many millions, and it is a reality for all of us here today. We're living in a time of huge uncertainty and change at a local, national, and global level. I gave my final public speech as chair of the Environment Agency on July the 12th. We were mid heatwave and at the start of the Conservative leadership context. Little did we know what was coming our way. On July 22nd, we hit a milestone in the UK's climate history when temperatures of 40 degrees were recorded for the first time. More than 2,800 excess deaths were noted. Since then, a third of Pakistan has been flooded. California has been pushed close to blackouts by a heatwave. Europe has suffered spectacular wildfires. The Yangtze River in China has dried up. 9 million people were told to evacuate as super typhoon Namado hit Japan. Hurricane Fiona wreaked havoc throughout the Caribbean to Canada, followed swiftly by Hurricane Ian, battering the east coast of the US. And more than 600 people have died and 1.3 million have been displaced from their homes in flooding that has hit 36 states and the capital. I sense I'm only skimming the surface of the climate shocks threatening lives and livelihoods around the world. The V20 group of finance ministers from 58 climate vulnerable economies reckon 20 years of climate impacts have cost their countries $525 billion. Developing countries face a 2030 bill ranging from either $290 billion to $580 billion, according to a 2019 study. And African nations are losing 5 to 15% of GDP annually due to impacts, says the Africa Development Bank. Leading insurer Aon reckons global economic losses from natural disasters in 2022 already total $227 billion, warning that the swathe of impacts in 2022 are in line with the global trend and support conclusions from the last IPCC assessment report. The science could not be clearer. 40% of the world's population is highly vulnerable to climate change. This is no longer a distant threat, but happening now. Conflicts around fossil fuels in many parts of the world are demonstrating the necessity to scale up and accelerate rather than derail a just transition towards cheaper, more accessible, more secure, zero carbon energy. 2022 also represents a turning point for the food and agricultural agenda and our relationship with nature. Surging food prices are of particular concern to Africa, Asia, and the Middle East that depend heavily on wheat imports. In a dangerously divided world, we need to invest now to prevent the worst of the climate and nature crisis and avoid further horrendous costs of inaction. So as we head to COP27, where do we look for reasons to be cheerful? I'm going to focus on three areas: net zero commitments, green finance opportunities, and investing in adaptation and resilience. Net zero targets now cover over 90% of the global economy, yet fewer than one fifth of net zero targets set by national and subnational governments and only a third of the largest public corporates with net zero targets actually meet science-aligned criteria, according to the Net Zero Tracker. The Breakthrough Agenda was designed to strengthen international collaboration where it is most needed. At COP26, leaders of 44 countries plus the European Union, representing over 70% of global GDP, committed to work together to make clean technologies and sustainable solutions the most affordable, accessible, and attractive option in high emitting sectors before the end of this decade. The first phase of work focuses on five sectors, which today account for over 50% of current emissions: power, hydrogen, road transport, steel, and agriculture. In each of the sectors, we see growing investment in solutions, but as world emissions continue to rise, progress is not yet fast enough to meet the goals that were agreed under the Breakthrough Agenda. Regarding corporate commitments, the UN Secretary General's high-level expert group on net zero will deliver its first set of recommendations to tackle poor corporate net zero targets during the first week of COP27. Chaired by ex-Canadian Minister for the Environment, Catherine McKenna, the group was mandated at COP26 to tackle the lack of accountability for corporate targets. Alongside these corporate commitments, there are massive green finance opportunities. And one way to think about green finance that might be helpful to this group in particular is to see it as the direct application of science to financial decision making. And I think this is critically important perspective for both the green finance and scientific communities to be emphasizing right now. Why? Because investing and lending in line with scientific consensus on climate change and the depletion of our natural resources is increasingly under attack from those who want to portray it as an indulgence that was tolerable when the basic metrics of corporate returns were supported by low levels of inflation, low corporate tax rates, historically low interest rates, and the high leverage, high margins, and high valuations that resulted. But now, as those fundamentals are changing and markets are correcting, the let's get back to the day job of delivering high risk adjusted returns, instead of focusing on environmental, social, and governance matters, is becoming a viewpoint that those with considerable influence are increasingly comfortable voicing in public. There may be over 450 financial institutions signed up to net zero goals by 2050, but money only moves if it can make money. And there is a lot of money to be made from financing new and expanding fossil fuel prospects. The top global banks lent $3.8 trillion towards just that between the Paris and the Glasgow climate conferences. We need far greater and more urgent focus on primary capital deployment. The net zero transition is a highly capital intensive business. And to date, we've focused a lot of energy on secondary market considerations, such as aligning equity portfolios with various metrics, which can only indirectly impact the availability and cost of capital for investments in new technologies and new projects. We now need equal vigour on deploying bank lending, bond issuance, initial public equity offerings, private equity, venture capital, real asset investments towards real economy direct investment. And in practice, that's going to mean radical collaboration between all aspects of the financial ecosystem. Far more emphasis on public capital, including the balance sheets of the multilateral banks and development finance institutions, as well as philanthropic capital being used to lower the risk for commercial mainstream capital to redeploy its money towards sustainable opportunities. A more effective use of limited public money may be to shift from grants to guarantees, crowding in private sector finance. We also know that investing in adaptation and resilience works. To give an example close to home and to my heart, last year, the Environment Agency completed the government's £2.6 billion six-year capital flood programme on time and on budget. It means 700 flood schemes are better protecting more than 300,000 homes, nearly 600,000 acres of agricultural land, thousands of businesses, and major pieces of infrastructure. The government has upped the budget of the new programme to a record £5.2 billion. And with a significant UK national infrastructure and construction pipeline out to 2030, it will be important that this infrastructure is built ready for the climate events that we know are locked in. I also believe the future lies in some form of adaptation standards, and this is relevant to the whole world, not just the UK. More work is needed to develop a strategic approach to managing climate risks. Presently, we do not know what the optimum level of investment is for the UK climate adaptation, or how this should be balanced between the public and private sectors. So I hope the UK government and other governments will consider asking the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance to commission reviews of the economics of resilience. This would consider the costs and benefits of resilience measures and the balance between public and private investments. Its conclusions would help establish a national ambition for climate resilience, embedded in all government departments, and enable us to reach net zero. After all, if construction does not properly consider rising floods and extreme heat, low carbon infrastructure could become prematurely obsolete. Initiatives such as the Coalition for Climate Resilient Investment are doing some much needed work in this space. Developed to address the massive gap in financing resilience, the Physical Climate Risk Assessment Methodology, PCRAM, published last month, is a global practitioner's guide that supplies the practical tools to identify and assess the resilience of infrastructure assets. The methodology facilitates a profound shift in the resilience narrative, by which resilience becomes a core component of innovative strategic decision-making. A rigorous integration of these risks should allow the unlocking of the upside, enabling countries and investors to become more competitive, attractive, and strategic instead of being penalized for acknowledging their exposure. And we're delighted to be working with the Egyptian government through the coalition. So to conclude, I am certain that if we can align all the work that we've heard about this evening and adapt the systems that underpin it, this decade will not just be the decade we pull the world back from the precipice of climate and nature catastrophe. It will be the decade we unlocked a just, resilient and sustainable path to prosperity for billions of people around the world. And finally, I was struck by these words from a book that is about to be published. Right now, we are in desperate need of hope, but hope is not about pretending that everything will be fine. To me, the author, hope is not something that is given to you. It is something you have to earn to create. It cannot be gained passively through standing by and waiting for someone else to do something. Hope is taking action. It's stepping outside your comfort zone. The clue of the author is in the next sentence. And if a bunch of weird school kids were able to get millions of people to start changing their lives, just imagine what we could all do together if we really tried. It's Greta Thunberg and her climate book. My final sentence, hope isn't just a noun, it's a verb. We have to do hope. So let's get on to it. Thank you very much.